Chapter 31. George Adams's face was a mask of concentration, his fingers curled tightly around the Robinson's controls. Wind and the furiously spinning main rotor blades made the small chopper jittery on the raised helipad, but he wouldn't take off until the timing was just right. The Oregon dropped down the back of a large swell, and a wall of water suddenly loomed up over the deck, its crest curled and threatening to swamp the helicopter and its three occupants. "Talk to me, Eric," he said as the ship started to climb the next wave. "Hold on. The camera's almost reached the top." "Okay, yeah. There's a large trough on the other side. You've got plenty of time." The instant the ship reached the apogee of its ascent, Adams gave the Robinson a bit more power, knowing that when they took off, the Oregon would drop from under them rather than rise up on a hidden wave and crash into the chopper. As they took to the air, the tramp freighter plummeted. George dipped the nose to gain airspeed and then lifted out of the reach of the surging sea and into a maelstrom of wind. He had to turn with the wind to gain more speed and altitude before swinging back into the gale. Hammered by a 50-knot headwind, the Robinson was making only 60 knots over the ocean, not much faster than the Oregon herself, but Juan had wanted to get to the Gulf of Sidra as quickly as possible. If the plan held, his ship would be in torpedo range by the time he and Eddie had finished laying the hypertherm charges. "I calculate our flight time to be 1 hour and 20 minutes," George said after settling in for the difficult flight. "Juan?" It was Max over the radio.
"Go ahead."
"Cassadine's sending another SOS.
"Okay.
Go ahead and answer it just like we talked about."
"You got it."
Max left the channel open so Cabrillo could hear the conversation. "Gulf of Sidra. This is the MV Oregon, Captain Max Hanley. I have heard your distress call and am making all possible speed to your location, but we're still 2 hours away."
"Oregon, thank God."
"Captain Cassadine, please advise on your situation."
"There's a split in the hull amidships, portside, and we're taking on water. My pumps are going at full capacity and we don't appear to be sinking, but if the tear gets any worse, we will have to abandon ship."
"Has the hole gotten any bigger since it first occurred?"
"Negative. A rogue wave running across the wind hit us and tore the plating. It has been stable since."
"If you turn due east, we can reach you quicker." This wasn't true, but if the Gulf of Sidra turned as she spewed her poison, it would distort the hurricane's eye somewhat. Basically, it was a test to see who had control on the ship, its master or Daniel Singer. Static filled the airwaves for almost a minute. When Cassadine came back, there was a new current of fear in his voice.
"That isn't possible, Oregon. My engineer reports damage to our steering gear."
"Most likely a gun to his head," Juan said to Max. They had considered this scenario, so Max went on as if it wasn't a big deal.
"Understood, damage to your steering. In that case, Captain, we can't risk a collision in these conditions. When we are 10 miles from you, I will request that you man your lifeboats."
"What? So you can put a line on my ship afterward and claim her for salvage?" Juan chuckled.
"This guy's facing death and he's worried we'll steal his vessel."
"Captain, the Oregon is a 1,000-ton commercial fishing boat," Max lied smoothly. "We couldn't tow a tanker on a mill pond, let alone in the teeth of a hurricane. I am just unwilling to risk a runaway derelict ramming us in the middle of this storm."
I understand," Cassadine finally said.
"How many souls aboard?"
3 officers, 12 crew, and 1 supernumerary. A total of 16.
The extra man would be Singer, Juan thought, realizing that was a small number even by tanker standards, which were so automated nowadays that they typically carried just a skeleton crew. But he supposed it was enough for what Singer intended.
Roger that, Max replied. 16 people. I will call you when we are in range. Oregon out.
Affirmative, Captain Hanley. I will radio immediately if our situation changes.
Gulf of Sidra out.
Don't get too used to that Captain Hanley stuff, Juan said when the tanker was off the air.
I don't know, Max said airily. Has a nice ring to it.
So do you think Singer will abandon with them?
Tough to say.
Though he's hit a setback, he might try to complete his mission without the crew aboard. They will need to slow in order to launch the lifeboat, but if Cassadine shows him how to get her back to speed, then he could finish tightening the storm into an eye less than 6 miles across.
Would you?
If I were him and I'd come this far?
Yeah.
I think I would see it through to the end.
Which means two things. One is that Singer's crazier than an outhouse rat, and two, you and Eddie better keep an eye out for him when you're laying the cutting charges.
We'll be careful.
An hour later, George radioed back to the Oregon that they had reached their first waypoint on the flight. It was time to clear the Gulf of Sidra of her crew.
This is the Oregon calling Captain Cassadine, Max said over the radio.
This is Cassadine.
Go ahead, Oregon. We are 10 miles from your position. Are you prepared to abandon ship? Max asked.
I do not want to argue, Captain, Cassadine replied, but my radar shows you are nearly 30 miles from us.
You're trusting radar in 20-foot seas? Max scoffed. My radar doesn't even show you. I'm relying on my GPS, and by our estimates, you're 10 miles from us.
Hanley rattled off the longitude and latitude numbers of a spot 10 miles due east of the Gulf of Sidra.
That is our current location.
Ah, yes. I see that you are correct and are within the 10 miles.
We can come in closer if you've made repairs to your rudder.
No, we have not.
But the supernumerary has volunteered to stay aboard to keep working on it.
The rest of you are abandoning him? Max asked, playing the part of a concerned mariner.
He is the vessel's owner and understands the risk, Cassadine told him.
Understood, Max said with mock unease. After you launch the boat and get clear of the tanker, steer a heading of 270 degrees and transmit a tone on the EPIRB emergency frequency so we can home in on you.
A heading of 270 degrees and a tone on 121.5 megahertz.
We will launch in a couple of minutes.
Good luck, Captain.
May God go with you, Max said seriously. Even if Cassadine and his crew were knowingly helping Singer, the sailor in him understood the dangers of getting into a lifeboat in this sea state. A quarter hour later, Hali Kasim put the 121.5 megahertz marine distress band on the op center speakers so everyone could hear the high-pitched directional tone.
Got that, Juan?
I hear it.
We're heading in.
Even flying at 500 feet, they only broke through the clouds when they were less than a mile from the supertanker. At 90,000 tons heavier than the Oregon, she rode the waves much more smoothly, with only occasional spray breaking over her blunt bows. They could just make out a tiny yellow speck motoring away from the red-decked behemoth. It was her lifeboat, and, like he'd been ordered, Cassadine was heading due west, well away from the Oregon, so there would be no chance he could interfere. They could also tell that the tanker was picking up steam again after slowing to send the lifeboat down its rails.
Check that out, George said and pointed.
Near the Gulf of Sidra's stern, a jet of fluid arced from her side about 8 feet below her rail. It was discharge from her sea suction intake, a system of pipes and pumps that allowed her to take on or expel ballast water. Only she wasn't pumping water. The fluid gushing from the 3-foot diameter hole was thick and viscous, like the oil that had contaminated the bay around the Petromax terminal in Angola. Only this was clear and seemed to spread across the ocean faster than the pump was ejecting it from the ship. "It's growing on its own," Eddie said from the back seat. Next to him were the thick ropes of hypertherm. "The organics within the gel are contaminating the surrounding water and turning it into goo." They circled the supertanker to take a look at that damage on her port side. There was a gash in the hull rising up from her waterline and extending to her railing. As the hull flexed with the waves, the rend opened and closed like a vertical mouth. The sea around the tear was coated with a growing skin of gelatin-thick flocculant. "Where do you want me to drop you?" George asked. "As close as you can to the bow," Juan said. "I don't want to risk getting doused by spray, so it'll have to be at least 100 feet back." "We won't have the time to hunt for Singer, so make sure when you come back to grab us you can do it quickly." "Trust me, Chairman, I don't want to hover over anything in this wind 1 microsecond longer than necessary." Adams looped them around and into the wind, coming at the tanker from an altitude of 100 feet, the restless sea seeming to pulse just below the landing skids. They crossed over the ship's rail, and George reined in the little chopper, holding her steady against the gusts in an expert flying demonstration as he dumped altitude. He maintained a hover 20 feet higher than the deck rose on even the biggest waves. "Eddie? Go!" Eddie Seng pushed open the door opposite him, fighting to keep it open with 1 foot while he used the other to kick the coils of hypertherm out of the helicopter. The explosives fell to the deck below like an entangled nest of snakes. When the last of it disappeared over the sill, he straightened and the wind slammed the door closed. "Now for the hard part," George muttered, keeping an eye on the horizon, gauging the swells and the frequency of the gusts. A few drops of rain pattered against the windscreen. He didn't let this ominous development crack his concentration. Juan and Eddie both waited with their hands poised on their door handles, their machine pistols slung across their backs. An explosion of spume erupted across the width of the tanker's bow as she plowed into another monster wave. As she started riding up it, George started to lower the Robinson. He'd judged it perfectly. The deck was no more than 5 feet from the chopper's skids when the ship started to settle again. "See you, boys." Cabrillo and Seng opened their doors and jumped without a moment's hesitation, freeing Adams to lift away from the ship before she slammed another wave in the unrelenting cycle. Juan hit the deck and rolled, immediately surprised at how hot the metal was. He could barely stand the temperature through the thick weave of his fatigues, and he got to his feet as fast as he could. He knew the heat would seep through the rubber soles of his boots in minutes. He didn't care about his prosthesis. He'd never feel it, but his other foot and Eddie's were in for first or second degree burns if this took too long. "This is going to suck," Eddie said, as if reading Juan's mind. "The spray hitting the bow should make it a little cooler there," Juan said as they reached the pile of hypertherm. He waved up at George in the Robinson, hovering 500 feet above them. Adams was their lookout in case Singer appeared. Because of the Gulf of Sidra's inertia, Juan had decided changing the ship's course or ramming her engine into full reverse would have little effect. The best chance of stopping Singer was laying the hypertherm as quickly as possible. The metal-cutting explosives were configured in 20-foot lengths with electricity-conducting clips on their ends so sections could be joined into a single charge. The detonator and battery pack could be set between any 2 segments, but in order to produce the desired results, they would need to set it as close to the middle as possible. Juan lifted ropes of the hypertherm over his shoulders until he felt his knees about to buckle. By the time he was finished, his left sock was soaked with perspiration.
Ready? He grunted. Let's go.
Staggering under their 150-pound loads, the two men marched toward the bow, both trailing dreadlocks of gray explosives. The wind and the ship's motion made them lurch drunkenly, but they fought on. When they finally reached an area soaked by spray, they saw tendrils of steam spiraling up from the deck. It reminded Juan of a visit to the hot springs at Yellowstone when he was a kid. He dumped his burden 30 feet from the prow. It was as close as they could get without risking being swept overboard by the eruptions of spray.
How are we looking, George? Juan panted.
I did a flyby of the bridge but didn't see anyone. The decks are a mess of pipes and manifolds. I don't see Singer anywhere.
How about you, Max?
We're within the torpedo's range and waiting for your signal.
Okay.
What Juan thought was an eruption of spray blasting over the front of the ship turned out to be a microburst of heavy rain. It slackened after a few seconds but didn't entirely abate. They had been running under two unforgiving deadlines. One was to prevent the tanker from completing its turn, and the other was to lay the explosives and be back aboard the Oregon before the rain made flying impossible. He could only hope they had better luck with the former. Eddie started laying the explosives across the width of the ship along one of the seams where two hull sections had been welded together. Juan was busy with the detonator, testing it a couple of times with the remote control he carried in his pocket before jacking it into the first length of hypertherm. It took 6 20-foot segments to span the tanker's beam. Each one contained a battery that, when activated, generated a magnetic field that anchored the explosives to the steel deck and prevented it from rolling with the ship. Eddie and Juan had to work together to lower a length over each of the tanker's sides so that some of the hypertherm dangled in the water. Again, the electromagnets clamped it to the hull along one of its welded seams. When they were finished, they had a line of explosives that covered every inch of the ship above the waterline. The extra lengths they left piled on the deck. Juan radioed George for extraction as soon as Eddie made the final connection. The rain was growing heavier, near horizontal sheets that cut visibility so the distant superstructure was as nebulous as a ghost. As Adams prepared to make the trickiest pickup of his distinguished career, Cabrillo called Hanley.
Max, the charges are laid. Go ahead and fire the torpedoes. We should be out of here by the time they arrive.
Roger that, Max replied. Back in the op center, Mark Murphy opened both outer tube doors and brought up the torpedo control program on his computer. Linked through the ship's radar and sonar systems, a three-dimensional wireframe representation of the tactical picture came up on his screen. He could clearly see the Gulf of Sidra steaming 7,000 yards from the Oregon. In the parlance of World War II submariners, this was going to be a turkey shoot. Webs, on my mark, fire tube one, Max ordered. Mark! Cocooned in a bubble of high-pressure compressed air, the 21-foot torpedo shot from the tube and put nearly 20 yards between itself and its mothership before the silver-zinc batteries engaged its electric motor. It took just a few seconds for the Test 71 to ramp up to its operational speed of 40 knots. On Mark's screen, he could see the torpedo streaking toward the tanker, tiny filaments representing her wire guidance cables trailing in its wake. For now, he let the fish run free, but he had a joystick control for when he needed to steer the weapon. Fire two! Murph launched the second torpedo, the sound of its discharge ringing through the ship like a hollow cough. After a moment, he said, both torpedoes away and running true. Juan, Max called, you've got a pair of fish on the way, so now's the time to get out of Dodge.
Working on it, Cabrillo replied.
He was looking up into the storm as George brought the Robinson lower and lower. It was his third attempt to put the chopper on the deck. The shrieking winds had aborted the first two when the Hilo was still 50 feet above the ship. A gust hit the helicopter and George compensated instantly, crabbing the aircraft to keep pace with the Sidra's 17-knot forward speed. "Come on, Georgie boy," Eddie said, lifting his feet to keep the soles from searing. "You can do it." The Robinson came lower still, its rotor wash whipping the rain off the deck in a circular pattern. They could see Adams behind the plexiglass windscreen. His movie star handsome face was taut with concentration, his eyes unblinking. The skids hovered a tantalizing 10 feet above the deck, and as the Sidra rose on another swell, the gap shrank. Eddie and Juan got into position so they could open the chopper's rear doors and dive in as quickly as possible. Adams managed to keep the helicopter exactly on station for nearly 15 seconds, waiting for the tanker to reach the top of the wave. When it started to drop again, he let the Robinson fall the last couple of feet. Cabrillo and Seng whipped open their doors and dove inside head first, even as the Hilo bounced back into the sky. Adams twisted the throttle sharply, and they lifted away from the supertanker. "That was one fancy piece of flying," Juan said, getting himself settled and his safety belt fastened. "Don't congratulate me yet." "I still have to land on the Oregon," Adams replied. Then he grinned. "But that was damn smooth, if I do say so myself." "Oh, just so you know, that crack amidships has gotten bigger. The deck's starting to split, too." "Won't make much of a difference now," Juan said and keyed his radio. "Max, we're away. Where are the torpedoes?" 2,000 yards and closing. Call it 4 minutes to impact." The Atlantic was too rough to see the weapons' tracks as they moved through the water, though the three men in the chopper hovering at 800 feet were going to have a spectacular view of their detonation. "I'll trigger the hypertherm 10 seconds before impact," Juan said. "Hitting her on both port and starboard will shear everything below her waterline, and the explosives will burn through everything above. The bow will come off like a piece of sliced bread." Murph came on the tactical net. "I'll call out the ranges. At 50 yards, go ahead and blow it." A tense 3 minutes passed as Mark guided the torpedoes so they would slam into both sides of the Gulf of Sidra in the exact spots below where Juan and Eddie had laid the hypertherm. Juan had the remote detonator in his hand, his thumb poised. 100 yards, Mark reported. As the torpedoes converged on the tanker, they drew closer to the surface, so it was possible to see the faint line of their wakes. Murph was vectoring them in perfectly. 75. With his keener vision, Adams was the first to spot it. "What the hell is that?" he suddenly shouted.
"What?
Where?"
"Movement on the deck."
Cabrillo saw it then, a tiny figure running from the Gulf of Sidra's bows. He was wearing a rain suit that was nearly the same shade of red as the tanker's deck, the perfect camouflage to stalk the maze of pipes in order to reach the bow unseen.
"It's Singer. Look away!"
He mashed the detonator button and turned his head to shield his eyes from the intensity of the burning hypertherm. When he didn't see the sun-bright luminescence in his peripheral vision, he stared at the ship. The hypertherm was still in place, but hadn't cooked off.
"Webs, abort! Abort! Abort!"
Mark Murphy could have triggered the torpedoes to self-destruct, but instead he sent a signal to slow the hurtling weapons and used both joysticks to send them diving. On his screen, he watched their descent. The angle looked all wrong for them to pass below the tanker's tremendous draft, but there was nothing more he could do. They were close enough now that an auto-destruct order would stave in the Sidra's hull and consign her to a lingering death that would allow her entire load of gel to escape. "Dive, baby, dive," Eric Stone said from his station next to Murph's. Max was holding his breath, watching the main monitor where it displayed the torpedo's paths. They passed within 6 feet of the tanker's flat bottom and within 11 feet of each other. Everyone in the op center let out a collective breath. "Get me down there," Juan shouted, pointing at the tanker. Adams threw the chopper in a steep dive before saying, "I can't guarantee I can pick you up again. We're low on fuel." "Doesn't matter." There was fury in Cabrillo's voice. The Robinson rushed over the tanker's bow like a hawk coming out of a stoop, its skids no more than 10 feet off the deck as Adams chased Singer down the length of the ship. Juan already had his safety belt off and was ready with his shoulder braced against his door. He unslung his MP5 and dumped it on the seat. When he jumped the first time, the machine pistol had gouged painfully into his back. This leap was going to be even tougher. Singer must have heard the chopper because he looked up over his shoulder. His eyes went wide, and he started running even harder. There was a dark object in his hand that Juan recognized as the detonator battery. Singer cut to his right, trying to get his pursuers to fly into a manifold tower rising 40 feet from the deck, and also to reach the rail so he could hurl the battery into the sea. Juan forced open his door. The drop was 10 feet, and the chopper was moving at least 10 miles per hour, but he leapt anyway. He hit hard, tumbling across the hot steel plates until he crashed into a pipe support. He hauled himself to his feet, his body feeling the collective result of so much punishment. He took off at a dead sprint, his pistol out of its holster and clutched tightly in his fist. Singer had seen him jump from the chopper and redoubled his pace, his long strides eating distance like a gazelle. But no matter how badly he wanted to toss the battery overboard and complete his mission, the man behind him was driven even harder. He glanced over his shoulder again to see Cabrillo gaining ground, his face a mask of rage. A fresh wave surged under the tanker, making her hull moan with the stress. The tear along her port side slammed closed as the swell buckled the keel. Then, as it passed by, the split opened again, tearing wider than before. Singer had seen the gap and was far enough from the rail to avoid it when it closed, but when it yawned open, he never thought it would rip the deck so easily. Singer tried to avoid it and was awkwardly shifting his weight when his foot fell through, shredding his rain pants and the flesh of his leg against the jagged edge. The paperback-sized battery pack went skittering. He screamed at the pain and his other leg fell into the hole, dangling above the slick surface of the flocculant still sloshing in the tank. The searing metal blistered his hands as he struggled to pull himself free before the gap slammed shut. Cabrillo dove into him at full speed just as the tanker shifted again and the two sides of the tear scissored closed. He tumbled with Singer amid a spray of warm liquid and a keening cry that pierced his brain. When he recovered from the fall, he looked at Singer. Everything below the top of his thighs had been cut off and had dropped into the tank. Blood spilled from the clean slices in torrents that turned pink in the rain. He crawled to Singer and turned him face up. He was ghostly pale and his lips had already turned blue. His screams suddenly ended as his brain refused to feel any more pain. He was slipping into shock. "Why?" Juan demanded before the man succumbed to the trauma.
"I had to," Singer whispered. "People have to act before it's too late."
"Haven't you figured out that the future takes care of itself? 100 years ago, you never saw the sun in London because of the industrial pollution. Technology evolved and the pall went away. Today you say the problem is cars causing global warming. In 10 or 20 years, something will come along that makes the internal combustion engine obsolete.
We can't wait that long. Then you should have spent your millions on inventing it sooner rather than squandering it on a demonstration that can't possibly change anything. That's the problem with your movement, Singer. You're all about propaganda and press releases, not concrete solutions.
The people would have demanded action, he said weakly, for a day or a week. To effect change, you need alternatives, not ultimatums.
Singer said nothing, but as he died, it was his defiance that was the last thing to fade from his eyes. Fanatics like him would never understand the nature of compromise, and Juan knew he shouldn't have bothered. He lurched to his feet to recover the battery pack and started running for the bow.
Talk to me, Max. You've got 3 minutes before the torpedoes run out their charges.
Because of the guide wires spooling out from the Oregon, the outer tube doors couldn't be closed to load any more torpedoes from the ship's store. If Juan didn't set off the hypertherm now, it would take 30 minutes to get 2 fresh torpedoes into the water, and he knew the Gulf of Sidra would break up before then.
Don't wait for me no matter what. If I can't detonate the hypertherm, hit the ship with the torpedoes anyway. Maybe we'll get lucky and the blast will ignite the cutting charges.
I hear you, but I don't like it.
How the hell do you think I feel? Juan said as he ran.
The tanker seemed impossibly long, her bows like a horizon that never grew closer. The heat radiating from the deck made his pores run with sweat, and each time his left foot slapped the ground, he could feel the blisters popping. He ignored it all and sprinted on.
2 minutes, Max said over the radio when Cabrillo finally reached the string of hypertherm bisecting the ship.
When Singer had yanked the battery from the detonator, he had torn the wires that carried the electricity to set off the charge. Juan had to first disconnect the detonator from between 2 lengths of the explosives so he didn't accidentally complete the circuit. Using the pocket knife Eddie had recovered at the Devil's Oasis, he had to peel back the plastic insulation to expose the copper before he could twist the wires back together. There were 3 of them, and it took 20 seconds each. A status light embedded in the detonator turned green. He had a complete circuit.
1 minute, Juan.
He clipped a length of hypertherm to one side of the detonator and was moving to the second when he heard over the radio,
Chairman, it's Murph. Torpedoes are 150 yards out.
Keep them coming. I've almost got it.
There.
The string was complete. He turned and started running aft, hampered by the stinging pain radiating from his charred foot. He was now in a race against 2 torpedoes homing in on the ship at 40 knots. He'd covered 100 feet when Murph reported the torpedoes were 100 yards away. He accelerated through the agony, not caring that he was crying out with every step.
50 yards, Chairman, Mark said, as if it were his fault.
Juan let it go for another few seconds, gaining a couple more feet before pressing the remote. In a blazing arc that rivaled the sun, the hypertherm ignited, its magnesium core spiking to 2,000 degrees. The burn raced from the center of the ship like lightning, making the steel deck as soft as wax and then heating it further so it dripped into the hold like water. The bow was wreathed in a noxious cloud of smoke and scorched metal. The light it gave off filled the sky, turning the cheerless gray into brilliant white. The explosive cut completely across the deck and then continued on, slicing open the hull down to the waterline in a blink of an eye. Juan could feel the intense thermal shock on his back from 300 feet away, and had it not been for the rain, he probably would have lost the hair on his head. As quickly as it had ignited and burned through the ship, the hypertherm exhausted itself, leaving in its passing a long, narrow gash with edges that glowed with residual heat. He managed to cover another 20 yards before the Test 71s hurtled into the ship directly below where the charge had cut the hull. The concussion from the twin explosions lifted him off his feet and threw him down the deck as water and torn metal geysered up from the blasts. The bow was torn free of the rest of the tanker and sank in an instant. The force of her passage through the ocean caused water to surge into her holds, forcing the nearly three-quarter load of flocculant to squeeze toward the stern through the pipes that connected the tanks. A gout erupted from the tear in her side, sending gel squirting more than 100 feet. They had known this would happen, but accepted it as a small price to pay as the remainder of the organic flocculant remained trapped within the ship. Juan staggered to his feet, his head pounding with an unholy ring. Looking forward, he could see the ocean climbing up over where the bow had been in a wall of water that seemed to grow in height as the ship settled into the sea's embrace. The Gulf of Sidra was sealing her own fate as her massive diesel engine continued to turn the propeller, ramming her under the waves at 17 knots.
Juan, it's George.
He looked up to see the chopper hovering above him. I think I have enough fuel to make one attempt.
You won't have time, Juan said as he ran aft again. This pig's sinking faster than I thought she would. She'll be gone in less than a minute.
I'm going to try anyway. I'll meet you at the stern rail. Cabrillo just kept running. And we're coming in, Max Hanley called from the Oregon. Rescue crews are gearing up now if you go into the drink. Juan ran on, coming down the starboard side of the ship so he could avoid where the hull had been breached. Behind him, the sea climbed higher. Already a third of the tanker was awash, and every second saw more of her go under. He reached the superstructure and raced down the narrow space between it and the rail, his legs pumping up the ever-steepening deck. He reached the Sidra's jackpost with its soaked Liberian flag just as water reached the leading edge of the accommodation block. There was no sign of George Adams in the Robinson. Cabrillo would just have to hold on and pray he didn't get sucked too deep when the ship plummeted out from under him. He had just started climbing over the rail when the chopper careened from around the crazily tilted superstructure. From its back door dangled a patchwork rope made of assault rifle slings, a fatigue jacket, some lengths of wire pilfered from somewhere in the cockpit, and Eddie Seng's pants looped at the bottom. A line of portholes one story above Cabrillo exploded, blown outward by the buildup of air pressure as water filled the superstructure. He turned away from the shower of glass that rained downward and looked up again in time to see Eddie's pants swinging at him. He leapt as they arced just above his head, slipping an arm through the pant legs, and was jerked into the air, spinning and twisting like a coin on the end of a string. Below him, the Gulf of Sidra vanished under the waves, her grave marked by a pool of gel many thousands of times smaller than what Daniel Singer had intended. The first person to greet them in the Oregon's hangar after George's unbelievable landing was Maurice. He was dressed impeccably in his trademark black suit with a crisp white towel over one arm. In the other, he held aloft a serving dish with a silver cover. As Juan staggered from the Robinson, and Max, Linda, and Sloane arrived in a jubilant rush, Maurice approached and whipped off the cover with a flourish.
As per your earlier request, Captain.
My earlier request?
Dulled by fatigue, Juan had no idea what the steward was talking about. Maurice was too dour to ever smile, but his eyes glinted with merriment.
I know this isn't technically a hurricane, but I believe you would enjoy your Gruyere cheese and lobster souffle with a baked Alaska for dessert.
His timing had been so perfect that the delicate souffle hadn't settled and steam curled from its top. Laughter echoed throughout the hangar. It would be the 10th squall of the year to form in the Atlantic, powerful enough to become a tropical storm, and thus deserve a name. Though it had started to evolve into a hurricane with a massive potential for destruction, the eye never seemed to fully form. Meteorologists had no explanation why. They'd never seen a phenomenon like it. It was just as well. It was early in the season to have this many storms, and a weary public wasn't really concerned with a hurricane that never was. In keeping with tradition, each storm was named after the corresponding letter in the alphabet, so that the first storm always has a name starting with the letter A, the second with the letter B, and so on. So when it came to the 10th storm, a storm that never made landfall, few would recall that it had been given the moniker of Tropical Storm Juan.